This is the Empower Podcast, released July 12th, 2020. Episode 500. 2.5 orders of magnitude.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
Does it even matter that we're at 500? It's like
a, it's fine.
You know, it's a shoulder shrug. Come on, 512 is what we're after.
Okay, I actually did have that thought the other day. 512 would be a little bit more. But, you know, I think the big thing about 500 for us, rather.
Yeah, it's half a decade.
We average about 50 episodes a year. So this is, we're getting pretty close. It's about, you know, two or three episodes away from our 10-year mark.
Our 10-year. Because when is 10 years?
Like our first show is August 10th, I think.
Oh, August, really?
Okay. Yeah, so it's like about a month away. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
10 years. Geez, you get less for murder.
Yeah.
Yep. No, but can we name this one? It occurred to me, 500, half an order of magnitude.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
Yeah, you like it? Okay. Yeah, let's run with that because, you know, orders of magnitude, it's a thing.
Yeah, that's what matters. You know, like that's how you should be estimating stuff. And that's great. I like that.
For you youngsters out there, I did a video on this, like it was probably 10 years ago. It was one of my like first 30 or something. And yeah, orders of how to impress at a job interview. It's like go in there and talk DBs and orders of magnitude. And you'll impress the hell out of people like you know what you're talking about. Now, that's, you know, to the nearest order.
Yeah, I think, well, making estimates is good as long as you, you know, don't show too much bravado about it, you know?
Right.
It's definitely this thing, you know?
And you've got to, like, engineering's the art of knowing when something doesn't matter and when something matters, right?
That's right.
Is when you need to be precise and when you don't need to be precise. There's no point, like, I know a lot of engineers who will, like, be anal retentive about specifying their resistor down to, you know, use the E96 range or something.
That's
and like, dude, you don't like it. Just use a one, just waking a 1K, you know, near enough.
Yep.
Like,
yep, totally.
Yeah.
Or they're paying a ton for 0.01% or, you know, like, yeah, it's like, yeah. And it doesn't have any impact. And basically then their sourcing sucks and they're, you know, it's
you're right.
Expensive. And yeah, it's a nightmare.
Oh, yeah, didn't I recently do a video? You know, I'm always doing my... Yeah, I did a recent video. God, I can't remember what it was. I didn't tear it down. I looked at an open source project and looking at how... They had like 60 different values of resistors on their bill of materials.
Oh, yeah. And you did like a bomb optimization.
Bomb optimization, yeah. And it was... Oh, my... Yeah. Yes, yeah. Tutorial PCB bomb consolidation, 1307.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it was like 60 different types. And it was like, and that would fill up a pick and place machine. Like a typical, just for the resistors. Yeah.
Yeah, and you were talking about like lowering the cost of assembly and stuff like that.
Lowering the risk as well of sourcing parts and stuff like that. Because, you know, you can just risk goofing it up if you can't get these. Your purchasing department's going around like crazy trying to purchase 60 different reels of resistors. And, you know, they ran out. You know, so you get a phone call at 2 a.m. in the morning from your assembly house because they're urgent, you know, in China, and it's like different time zone or whatever. And you get a call saying, oh, we ran out of 1.02K resistors, you know, and it's like, is it okay if we use a 1K?
And even if they have to call and ask, that costs time and, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Your sleep and
the everything line else. Stop and the production line stopped, and that means you can miss a deadline, and bingo, things just have a way of cascading out of control, you know, and just into big delays and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Speaking of delays, can we get into the, you cannot buy an analog discovery.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's from Vigilant.
Apparently.
Yeah. They wrote an email about it already. Did we link this post as well?
Yeah. Yeah. It's on the Reddit.
Yeah. And so Caitlin's one of the product managers. She is the product manager for Analog Discovery. And I talked to her about it a little bit, and it's just like all their stuff is tied up in medical and, you know, like a lot of getting the parts. That's one problem. The other problem is you think about every single engineering department in the country, at least in the US, probably a lot more. There's a ton of educational material around this, and they all basically are like, oh shit, we need 200 analog Discovery 2s
yeah.
before September. And they're all trying to buy them at once. So yeah, I don't know. I actually gave one to, I was working with someone who is a software person, and I gave him my Analog Discovery 2. I used them for contextual electronics.
Yes, I had two of them. I gave one away as well. And yeah.
So I gave mine away. This is like my travel scope, you know, like that's what I take and I use a lot. And so I was like, oh my God, I went on eBay and just like bought one. Just like, luckily right. Someone was like, oh, I don't do electronics anymore. They just sold
sell
me
it
cheap.
A second hand. Like, yep.
Yeah. And so keep an eye out on eBay. That's a market that's, my goodness, it's, yeah.
Mm.
I mean, and just like you think about all the education, right? We're in July, right? So, we're 2 months away.
Two months away from what?
Two months away from a new semester, maybe even less. I guess even less.
Oh, it's actually less here. Yeah. They start in July here. Yeah.
Oh, they do? Okay.
Yeah.
So like...
Unless it's a tri-semester based one, which some universities in Australia are, they've moved over to the, like when I was a boy, there was none of this tri-semester rubbish. It was, you know, but no, a lot of courses start in July right now. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Good luck.
And it's, but like you think about the supply chain, even if everything else was good, you've got to get all of these out to all of your students. And it's like...
Yeah.
I mean, so we had Brock on the show. Brock Lemaire was on the show 3 episodes ago, and he was talking about some of this stuff, and he's doing like embedded remotely, right? And that's like with DevWars, which is good. But like when you start to like move out of the digital realm into the analog realm, like, oh my God, what are you going to do? You know, like you need something like this, or you have to like then refer people to like your video and, you know, your video about like putting together a lab and be like, well, good luck, buy all the components too. It's like, oh, it's just a really big ask for students, you know?
Oh, it is. And this is something that David, too, was into. He used to work at the University of Technology. He was he did some tutoring there as well as he was basically working in a lab. He was actually designing all of the educational kits and things that these kids, some of them were quite complex, right? They're like, you know, 4 or 6 layer boards there, you know, and fairly complicated, lots of parts to do all sorts of various, you know, examples and demos and things like that. And he was getting like hundreds of boards made at a time.
Yeah. I mean, the scale of education, you not only need for all the students,
yeah,
but you have to imagine a bunch of students are going to blow them up too. So you need some backups,
yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, you've got to buy more, and each student needed one. And it was like, you know, and you got, and especially in the different stages of the courses and things like that. And you needed like, yeah, they were doing like runs of 500. And he was saying like sometimes he was like hand assembling these things, working late into the night, you know, hand assembling or hand finalizing or whatever hundreds of these kits and testing them and make sure they work.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of awkward number where you start putting effort into designing automated test jigs to actually test the boards and things like that,
right.
Because you've got to make sure they all work so that, you know, so that the lessons can work. You don't want some student, well, I do personally, I love it when things fail because that's when you learn the most, of course. So, great, your board doesn't work. Fantastic, let's troubleshoot it. You might actually learn something during your degree. And
yeah, but doing that times 100 or 200 is, I mean, like...
It's a lot. It's a lot of effort.
Yeah.
And,
and if
boy.
It's the equipment that's not working versus, like, the experiment, that's something else entirely. So,
have I told the story?
Well, the 500 episodes in, yes,
probably.
You
I've probably stolen someone will remember that. Oh, yeah, he did that in episode 82. And, yeah, I was doing, like, a digital logic class, and we had this, breadboard. We were building up all this breadboard, you know, breadboarding up some complicated, you know, digital thing with, you know, a dozen TTL chips or whatnot. And, you know, it was adders and divide, you know, it was doing all sorts of stuff. And we were building this up, and nobody's worked. And I'm, like, and before I build it up, I'm looking at the circuit, and I'm going, this probably isn't going to work. And because like, anyway, everyone built it up. It didn't work, but I went like, so I built it up as per the schematic, but I knew this probably wasn't going to work. And sure enough, it didn't work. And then with minutes, I had it fixed and nobody else had this fixed. And mine was the only one working in the end. What was it? It was a fan out. We were using like 7.4. I think we were, might be showing my age, but I think we might have even been using like 7.4, not 7.4 LS. I think it was like 7.4 series logic. Anyway, it was a fan out problem. We had like one gate driving like, you know, 12 others. And I'm going, I don't think this is going to work. And and sure
just
enough,
the drive strength, you mean, and like getting all the way across the board.
Yeah, it's like nobody had tested this, and sure enough, it didn't work. It only had a fan out of like 3 or 4 or something like that, and it just didn't work. If people don't know what fan out is, it's chips have a certain drive capability. They can drive a certain amount of current whilst keeping the minimum low and high threshold levels required. There's high drive and there's low drive from the totem pole output. And it can drive enough current so that it can drive all the inputs to all the other chips. And this isn't a problem on CMOS. It only becomes a problem on CMOS when you have actually capacitance on the line, where the capacitance becomes the load at
big
frequency
cable or something.
The long wires, all the input gates have X amount of capacitance and stuff like that. Because essentially a CMOS device is, you know, infinite input impedance, essentially.
Right. Except for with the Miller thing we could talk about.
And we'll segue into that one. And it didn't work. And to my apparently we ran out of time or something. And they just passed everyone. It's like, you got to be kidding.
Oh, no.
Mine's the only one that I was pissed off. Mine was the only one that worked. I was the only one that figured it out. And it was like, but everyone passed anyway. I was like, come on. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. So.
But you're not holding a grudge all these years later. That's
no,
I'm
not,
thing,
not,
right?
not yeah. holding a grudge. Yeah. Anyway, that one sticks in my mind.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, and they wouldn't believe me. They wouldn't. I think the thing why it sticks in the mind is because they wouldn't believe me. They went, oh, no, it's a fluke that yours is working. We don't know why yours is working. And it's like, no, I can tell you it's the fan out. And I tried to explain, and they wouldn't believe me that fan out was a thing.
Who was they in this case? Was there someone who was actually
I can't remember if it was our actual lecturer, our digital electronics lecturer, or whether or not it was what's the name of the
grad student or teaching assistant?
Grad student or teaching assistant. Because it was just a lab. So it might have been just a teaching, but these are graduates, right? These are,
I don't know.
Aren't they?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm not saying they're not capable. I'm saying it's more of a, if you're not writing it, you're just like, just do the lab, man.
I'm going for a smoko afterwards just to finish the lab, man. Come on. It's like,
I mean, they got other things going on,
have to get to the uni bar,
that's right. Yes. yep
oh boy. Anyway, yep.
So Miller plateau, this is a thing that James the bald engineer had did a video about. It was pretty good. It was basically showing the effects of Miller capacitance, and basically when you don't have any, basically saying, hey, throw a resistor on the input gate to a capacitor,
a FET.
Yep. It was interesting to see the actual traces, and he actually shows how the traces change and what the inputs look like as you change the resistance out. So it was a pretty neat explanation. I've read about Miller capacitance, and I've looked at it, but I've never really seen it in practice, because I usually do have either inline resistance from a PCB, or there's actually a resistor there and stuff like that. Or I just
most people, and it really comes into its play in power MOSFETs. And so unless you're doing really power MOSFET-y, big grunty driver type stuff, like motor drivers and stuff like that, that's probably not going to come into play. So anyway, the Miller plateau is where you charge. I'm not big on it, but it's where the gate charges up, and it's at certain VGS threshold levels, it instead of continuing to ramp up, it actually plateaus out. The charge actually plateaus out, or something like that. So, yep, I'm totally butchering that. I'm totally butchering it. it's been a long time since I've looked at that. So, yep, and I haven't seen the video. So I'm sure if you watch the video, I'm sure it's all explained.
The real problem is, Dave, that you're spending all your time watching other stuff like Amazon Prime movies.
You had to bring this up. You said you'd bring this up at the start of the show. I don't know why.
I think it's here's the thing. I catch it on Twitter because you're like, oh, I spotted an oscilloscope. And that's kind of interesting. But then sometimes you post the videos, the movies that you're watching, I'm just like, what the hell is he watching? And I will tell you, I used to watch stuff like this. I used to go over to my buddy's house. His dad had a collection of like 1980s, like really terrible sci-fi, like the worst grade stuff you could get, like Plan B from Outer Space, but like
right
times a every he like collected bad stuff, and so we used to go and watch that stuff.
Right.
So I'm not against it per se, but because you do it, you know.
I don't necessarily watch them all. Like I didn't watch that like invasion from Mars, this Japanese invasion Mars from 1970 that I tweeted the other day. I didn't actually watch that one.
There's some real bad ones out there, you know, like what got funded. I guess they're low budget anyway, so it's not that.
Oh, they're super low budget. I wonder how much it cost Amazon Prime. Probably nothing. Like, you know, pennies on the dollar for.
Oh, I bet nothing at all. I bet that gets thrown in, but basically it's like the throwaway from the, right, you know, from like
the studio. Because you sign up for studios, don't you? And then you get all
exactly.
I think something like that, and you just get all. So they paid the studio X amount, and they got 1,000 B grade.
Yep.
Oh man, just to say, we've got 10,000 titles on our streaming platform, and you go and actually watch. But there's so many now, so many streaming platforms.
Before,
5-7 years ago, it was Netflix and that was pretty much it.
So I saw an image the other day that, yes, that's correct. I mean, it was not much. I saw a image the other day that said like, it showed like different streaming platforms and like their various costs. And it was like Netflix, $120 a year, or, you know, Amazon Prime, $99 a year. And I kept on going down the list. And then at the bottom it had Harvard, $50,493 a year, because it's like because it's true, right? All of these schools is basically like this is really, really expensive streaming service, which is like kind of messed up, you know. I don't know, like, if we have students listening out there, I'm sure we do, I feel for you. I don't know what the hell I would do in your scenario. Just keep making stuff. That's the important thing, you know. That's like all you can do these days, because it's
what situation you're talking about. You're talking about that everyone's
it's
doing
like universities, you know, like I wouldn't have, I would burn out, you know, like I would just end up watching TV all day instead. Like if I was just,
right,
if I had to, like, if I didn't have the in-person element of it,
right,
I would
if
just.
If you physically weren't there, you would.
Yeah, I just wouldn't lock in. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'd be a slack ass. Yeah. I mean, like, I just, I'm okay now because I'm like in and into it. But like when I was when I was younger and frustrated with a lot of things, like, you know, like not frustrated with a lot of, you know, like when I was learning,
just
like
young.
Learning is tough when you're. When you're on your own, it's like, it's a difficult thing. So
this spills over to the gym. A lot of people ask, do I do weights like at the gym? Mm-hmm. No, I do classes because if I just wander in the gym on my own and try and do just free weights, I'm just going to be a slack ass, you know?
Yep.
Whereas if I'm in a class with 10, 20 other people, wow, I just go berserker, right? Mm-hmm. It's a, you know, it's an interactive thing. It's like, you know. And it's almost a competition too.
Yeah, there's the competition aspect for sure. Yep. Yeah. It's just a tough time. I mean, I I feel especially for people that are getting started, like it's, I don't know. And like, there's so many things that people could learn too.
Yep.
Like that it's like, there's like this like underlying guilt that people, like some people are just like depressed and, you know, it's tough to get anything done these days during, you know, lockdowns if people are still in that. And it's like, you know, I don't know. It's like, it's just a real tough time for learning, I think. So.
Well, here you go. I didn't say this is not on the list, but I will send you the link to this. There's just came out the other day, big news story. It made all the rounds here. Almost half of Australian PhD students considering disengaging from studies due to the pandemic.
Wow.
This is like, they reckon 5% of PhD students in Australia are currently or about to experience homelessness. And 11% are skipping meals. It's like,
that's really messed up. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, PhD students live on the edge anyway. It's like such a low payment, you know, like stipends are usually low anyway.
Like I don't know what's like in the US, but here in Australia, the tradition is that you, when you study, you don't go to university study. We've talked about this many times. You like stay at home with your parents. That's the way it's done. And like the parents are going to feed you and you don't have to worry about getting that second job, you know, to pay for your, you know, rent or whatever.
Yeah.
The whole dorm thing is not a thing here in Australia. It's only for overseas students. So I find this remarkable.
Yeah. Is it also the case for PhDs? Do you know? I mean, like, I don't know if you would have.
Well, I assume. Well, I don't know. You know, I've never done a PhD. I don't know about that sort of crowd. But
I got a PhD in the School of Hard Knocks, right?
School of Hard Knocks, right? Exactly. Word. Yeah. And I just, yeah, I find that really remarkable. These must be overseas students. But overseas students, they'd probably have their parents paying them to come here, usually. So I just find that remarkable because we have such a culture of staying at home. And that actually determines which university you go to here in Australia. It's like, well, which one's closest to home? Do they have a course I want? Yep, I'll go there.
That's the thing that I don't get about that whole system is like, what if it sucks?
It doesn't matter. See, people don't care here unlike the US, it is not, when you go into the job market, it's like, do you have a degree or not? It doesn't matter where you got it. Unlike the US is much more... tribal in that respect.
Pedigree, tribal.
Yeah, here it's like, no one cares. It's, you know.
I mean, I guess I shouldn't really say that it matters anyways, because I'm kind of like, oh, you shouldn't, you know, school doesn't matter that much.
Right.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, it's so ingrained in my brain, you know. Well, we've talked about that many times, so.
Uh-huh.
Huh, well, so, I'm feeling bad for all the PhDs out there, and I'm sure it's not just Australia either. So
no, yeah, it could be. Maybe it's elsewhere as well. But yeah, I don't know if the article, how accurate the article is. You know,
sure.
The Guardian. Yeah. It's like, you know, I don't know. But but yeah, that's really remarkable. So please, if you're a PhD student, leave it in the comments down below. Like, do you know other students struggling?
Yeah.
To make ends meet.
Yeah, and some of it, I think, like, you know, people can do amazing things at home and on their own as well. And like, I think I'd like to bring up some of the tools that are doing these kind of, that are like enabling these things. But like I said, it's still tough to do that. It's still tough to get motivated to actually go out and want to learn these things. But like, it is kind of amazing. On the flip side, I suppose, it's right. kind of amazing what's now available. And so we're going to talk about more about this next week. So Tim Ansel is going to be on the show again next week. But one of the big stories is that Google is the new open source PDK. And then Google's offering free fabbing for 130 nanometer chips. So next week, we're going to talk to Tim about that. What did you think about this whole thing, Dave?
Can we repeat that? Google is offering free semiconductor wafer fabbing for 130 nanometer technology. Free for open source chips. It has to be an open source chip.
Yep. And it's got to be on GitHub, I think, or GitHub, GitLab or whatever.
Right. And so is this available to anyone? Do you have to be like, I haven't looked into the details. Do you have to be like a university department? Like, do you have to be like you can just be in your.
You have to apply and then you have to be.
You've got to apply. Right. So it's not automatic. It's not like, hey, it's, you know, right.
Yep.
So, and does it have to be substantial? Will they do, hey, I'm going to do an open source 555 wafer chip, you know, like, and will they accept that or not?
You have to design it. I mean,
of course, you got to use the tools. And they're offering the free tools, right? Because the tools aren't normally free, is that?
The tools are free. I think these
tools are free, right?
I think so. I think this is using Electron. Like I said, we'll find out more next week. Tim will be on the show next week.
Yeah, it's called the SkyWater PDK,
which is the fab itself, the foundry rather.
Yep.
So SkyWater Foundry, the PDK is the process development kit. And so basically, we've talked about this a little bit on the show in the past, not the open source nature of it, but basically once you get access to the PDK, that gives you like, oh, here are the standard cell transistors you have access to. And then, you know, you can start to tweak some parameters, as far as I understand, at least. Again,
does it come with the software to actually lay out the, you know, components, or like, I just don't know. I've never designed a chip. Like, I've never actually at the silicon level. I don't know the tools. Is there another tool that, is this just like the library and you have to then use your silicon CAD tool of choice, or?
Yeah, I think that would probably be a good way to make an analogy. It's like, this would be like someone handing you a library of footprints and symbols.
That's right. Yep.
You have to plug it into a layout program. That has all of the DRC checking and all the, you know, and it does have parallels as far as I understand it. There is an open source one called, I want to say Electron, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah,
know if that's
I
right.
think that, that
we've talked about one of them
yeah,
on
yeah,
the show before.
Yeah.
And it's real ugly, and it was real ugly last time I looked at it. It was all Java based and it was real ugly looking.
Right.
But I think it's still alive. And I think, so I think that's one. And obviously, then there's also like Cadence, which is like, okay.
Yeah, well, but who's got access to that?
Who's got 50 grand sitting around and then being like, exactly. Oh, okay.
50? 50, it'd get you the bare bones. Well, get you the bare bones. Wouldn't even get you the bare bones, would it?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like.
But I think the PDK is like the plugin piece that then basically is like the footprint library.
Think of it as the footprint and component library. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which has all the, you know, yes, here's a flip flop. Here's a, you know, here's a MOSFET. Mm-hmm. Here's a. Yep.
I mean, here's a single transistor, honestly. I think that's some of it too.
So what is this process node capable of? Is it capable of like analog-y stuff? Like, is it capable of mixed signal or is it?
It is not. It is not right now. So
it is not. So it's digital
Tim
only.
Talks about that a little bit in the dial-up talk. So that's the linked video in there. It is digital only right now. I think they're working on an analog solution.
Okay.
But I think, I'm pretty sure it was no analog. There are, you know, you can have like, inductors, capacitors, like all that kind of stuff, but
right. But you really wouldn't need those in a digital design anyway, really, apart from pull-ups and stuff like that, and other open drain outputs and inputs and things like that. So, could you take like if you had an existing VHDL design, could you just like import that like and compile that to your own custom silicon? Is that possible? Do you have to use?
Yeah. No, you do have to. I mean, you need a tool for it, right? You need some kind of like placement tool, right? Let's say place and route does, right? But I don't think you would take like a VHDL, or sorry, you wouldn't take like the placement file from like a FPGA tool and then be like, oh, I have a chip now, right? Because
no, of course. But if you had your VHDL code, right, could you import that into one of these layout tools and then it pulled the libraries in that it needed and and then it mapped, here's a shift register and it maps that in. Here's a flip-flop. It maps that in. And then we just don't know. We have to use the tool.
You lost me about 5 minutes ago. Yeah. So next week we'll have all this and more in episode 501.
We'll be answered.
Tim Ansel.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic.
But it's interesting. I mean, like it's an interesting time at the very least. I mean, the fact that Google's doing this and the fact that it's, it's driving open source forward, which is interesting.
Yep.
Someone, who was it talking about it? But it was interesting, like comparing a Google versus an Apple, right? Both are talking about chip design, right? Apple now has, and Google's done chip design as well, I believe, like internally. But like Apple's going like more closed, which is kind of on brand. And Google's like,
well,
they're
switching to ARM, but they're doing their own variant.
Right. They're doing
the
design.
Like,
right, exactly. Yeah, it's not like Apple was open ever, but I'm just saying that like, I forget who it was. They were comparing the two and it was interesting, like contrast.
Right.
So we like the open stuff here. That's great. So we'll see how that all goes. I mean, I don't know.
Can I mention my prediction I put on Twitter here?
Sure.
That Apple, I made the prediction that Apple are going to buy a semiconductor company in the next couple of years.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
That is my prediction because they need to vertically integrate more and Apple's all about profit margin, right? They've got $200 billion in cash sitting there, right? And they usually use this cash. The reason that Apple makes such great margins, they're such a profitable company, is that they use that cash that they've built up to buy, 100 million processors, right? They 100 million memory chips, right? They buy up years worth of, they buy up entire production lines worth of chips, right? So all these memory makers, they'll just be churning out chips for Apple because they're, so they use it to get volume discounts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the next logical move from that.
I think this is the opposite of logical.
Well, why?
Because why would you take on that risk then? I mean, like, basically, you're throwing your weight around. You got this huge club that you can, hit people over the head with your cash
called
availability.
Cash,
and then you're like, maybe I should hit myself over the head. I don't know. Like, chip fabs suck, man. Like,
yeah, but the chip fab keeps running itself. I'm not talking about them starting up their own chip fab from scratch. I'm talking about buying
an existing
player.
Yeah.
And because they, and let them run it, continue to run it how they would, but they don't have to pay any margin on top. So it's, Apple's all about margin, right? So they would get the chips cheaper than everyone else because they own the company.
So you're saying cheapest chips.
Cheapest chips. Anyway, I would not be surprised if that's happened.
It's interesting. I mean, it's an interesting idea.
I probably wouldn't bet money on
it's very
but,
wonky,
you know,
but it's
not wonky. It's like, it'd be a big...
No, not wonky is bad. I mean, it's like, you're like a wonk, right. You know, like this is a wonkish opinion.
Wonk? No,
a wonk is like an expert who like a political wonk is someone who like basically analyzes the political spectrum and then it's like a wonky is like a is usually like a negative connotation, but to be like wonkish or to be a wonk is to, you know, someone who like
I haven't heard analyzes before. I've just heard wonky, you know, it's like it's
that is a negative connotation.
Like it's going to fall apart. It's wonky.
Right.
So, interesting. Okay. Anyway, so that may or may not come true. So if it comes true, damn it, I'm going to say I called it. And if it doesn't come true, I'll just forget about it. Okay. So the great
benefit of making predictions. Who was that? Yeah, right.
Nobody ever looks back and, you know, oh, your prediction was shit. Anyway. I just think it seems to make sense because Apple's all about screwing those margins. So, Anyway, that'll be interesting if it happens.
Yeah.
What else we got?
I'm looking through this thing now. Let's see.
Such professionals here on our 500th episode. Oh, talking about the open source thing. We can segue into the open source thing. There's a new DIN standard for open source I don't get this. I downloaded the zip file.
I don't either.
Okay, it's open source hardware requirements for technical documentation. It's been released. It's the DIN spec 3105 for those playing log at home. Mm-hmm. And I downloaded the zip file of the, you know, that was posted on Twitter by, who posted on Twitter? I can't remember, sorry.
Jeremy Bonvoisin.
Okay. Good on you, Jeremy. And I downloaded and it's got like, well, there's the hardware symbol and there's this .md file. What's a .md file?
That is a that's a documentation file in Git.
In
so
Git.
If you have it,
right.
If you have a .md, it'll show as the first. That's like the cover page. So usually it's readme.md.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So it's just a text file, is it?
Yep. Yeah, it's like a markdown. That's what it is. .md is markdown. Sorry.
Markdown language. Right. Got it. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Right. I need to extract this right about now and stick with me for a minute. I'll get it.
Yeah.
And
well, while you're doing that, it took me a long time to find out that DIN is German coming Deutsch Institut für Normung.
Sorry. Something like that.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. But that's what I never knew. So I always knew the term DIN rail, but I didn't realize it's actually a standard that comes from a standards body in Germany. And that's what DIN is.
And a DIN connector and a, you know,
What's a DIN connector? I don't know what that
is. A DIN connector, the 5-pin DIN connector. You know, the old keyboard connector from, you know, old school PS2, old PC keyboard. DIN PS2 connector. Would have.
I didn't know that. Okay.
No, not, PS2 is a mini DIN or whatever. DIN connector is your traditional, you know, circular plug. Okay,
it almost
with
looks like a
pins.
MIDI connection.
It's
like
a MIDI connector MIDI. is a DIN connector, yeah.
Oh, it is, okay.
I think, yeah.
So it's basically like the outer, so it's got like a circular outer shell and then like
yes, and multiple pins in there, yeah. That's the DIN standard. Yeah.
I think this might have been pre-Chris.
Okay, right, pre-Chris. Yeah, this was like, yeah, this is like 70s era connectors.
Chris was too either not existent or too young to be allowed to unplug things.
Basically, if you look at every vintage PC from the 70s and probably up to the mid-80s, DIN connectors were the thing. They're what your keyboards plugged into. Serial, you'd even get a serial DIN connector. Mm-hmm. You know, none of this D9 rubbish. It was, you know, D25. It was,
Right. It was something DIN, that can make a DB9 look small.
exactly. It was, you know, that was the thing.
I'm
because
not
they
sure
came
if that's
going to
hold
know,
on. Let's get a little bit more steel on that, you know? DIN 476 is international paper sizes. Wow, they really do a lot of stuff.
That's gotta be a
tight ship. Can you imagine working at a German Institute office?
Oh
my goodness.
German Standards Institute. Oh boy.
Yeah, I just
all you Germans out there, but we're stereotyping.
Yeah, we love you. It's like it's just like that must be intense. Not bad. It's just intense, you know.
But I'm sure it actually produces the finest standards out there.
I'm sure it does. And like so the A series, so DIN 476 is the A series paper sizes, which the US still hasn't adopted, which is stupid, but you know.
Yeah, it's dumb.
We still have letter and tabloid.
That's so retarded. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not great. It's, you know, 8.5 by 11 though. You know, that's
no.
You know, Yankee units.
8.5 by 11 Yeah. What, freedom inches? Units. Come on. This is inches. Ridiculous.
That's right. Yeah.
Get with the program. It's just, no. Like A's are perfect. Like A, like an A1 is half the size of an A0. An A2 is half the size of an A1.
I mean, let's just start at metric, Dave. Come on.
Right. Small steps.
I think we have lots of things we could point to that are a little off around these parts. So anyways, you were saying, I think the reason that this is interesting from a high level is that it's, you know, a German standards body, and now it's open source, though. Like, so, like, people can contribute to it.
Yeah, yeah. Like, okay, I'm reading it, and I do not know what I'm reading. I have no idea what this is trying to do.
This repository and holds open standards in the field of open source hardware.
To the corresponding documentation.
I think this is basically trying to make, you know, so like there's open source hardware summit group, Oshawa. They also have, you know, standards and stuff like that.
They've got their own, yeah.
Yeah, thing and that so I think this is trying to standardize in that same way, but through DIN.
Right. Yeah. It's just like you read it and you go, you just go, what?
So here we go. DIN spec 3501-2 defines requirements for implementing a community-based certification procedure for open source hardware. Okay, that's cool. DIN spec 3501-1 delivers an unambiguous and operational definition of concept of open source hardware and breaks it into objective criteria for judging the compliance of a piece of hardware with this definition. So basically, yeah, this is just another way to say, is it or is it not open source hardware? If it is, here's how we certify it, I guess.
Yeah, I guess.
What happens though if you like? Can you like fork? Can you fork a DIN spec now? That's kind of interesting.
I don't know, but like it's just so wordy and weird, and it's like, like seriously, people have to go check this out for themselves because it's quite. I've got to sit down and actually you really have to concentrate to read this. It's not something I can do while talking at the same time. My brain just doesn't have the bandwidth to do it.
I think someone brought this. I think when I was in Germany for Chaos Camp, I think someone brought this up. I remember hearing about this at some point, and it was like in process. And I'm sorry if that person's listening and they were telling me and they're like, Chris is going to remember exactly what I'm saying. I did not remember.
Right.
Yeah, it's okay. Well, we'll see. You know, like we'll see. I think it's just like any other open source, whatever open source hardware. It's like, you know, it's only there's always a lot of like struggle around it. You know, like a lot of like people want to get it right. They want to make it standardized, and that's what a standard is, right? It's like a you know, it has a set of definitions, and people agree to it, and it's like community certified. Blah 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 blah. You know, like it kind of. Like now that it's there, I kind of forget about it. So like that's just my personal like it is important, but it's just like I've just kind of forgotten about it. And now this is a new one, and I'm sure once it's standardized, I'll be like, oh, okay. I've forgotten about it.
With open source hardware, most people just shrug their shoulders and just don't care. They'll just do whatever they want. You know, it's just throw some random license.
It's great
on
that
it
people are doing it. It's great that people are doing it. And I feel like there's always these things like I see this with some of the software podcasts I listen to and sometimes I see this in the firmware projects and software projects that I follow. There are some very real implications. I never run into them because it's not like I'm not doing big enough software projects that it matters. But like I can imagine a scenario where it's like, you know, some of the licensors are like, no, if you have this piece of code in your software, the rest of your software is open source. And it's like, oh my God, that's a huge deal. You know,
that could be a legal minefield for company. And it is like, there's been lawsuits about this sort of stuff, you know?
Right. And so I'm just grateful I don't have to deal with it. You know, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. I tried to do my own little, it wasn't a standard, but I tried to come up with a new concept
for the seven thingies. What has to be open about it?
Yep. And the Creative Commons, it was kind of making open hardware sort of like the Creative Commons letters, you know, to have it, you know, like the CC BY, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That sort of thing. The same thing for open hardware. And there's quite a few people who have taken that up and actually continue to take that up. They actually put the little letters on their, you know, logo and stuff like that. Which I still think it's an excellent idea, because at a glance you can tell from the logo what people are giving away.
Do you think your own idea is excellent?
Yep. Damn right I do.
This is very surprising. Because
it solves a real problem. It solves a real problem. Right? It does. Standards are one thing. Standards are one thing. Okay? And then you have real world problems.
Iconography. That's what you're talking about. You're talking about iconography.
Yes. There are real world problems that people need to solve. And one of those is what people are actually releasing and making open. It's like, they will stick the logo on it.
Here's where Dave gets his PhD. This is what Dave goes back and he gets his PhD in this thing, whatever it is. And he just goes to conferences and argues with people for the rest of his friggin' life. Dr. Jones. Yeah.
I'm an engineer. Sue me. If there's a problem out there, I want to solve it. One of the problems is you can't tell what they've actually released, right? It's like, is it?
I've been waiting to say this for years, Dave. I'm going to say it right here. Okie dokie, Dr. Jones.
Oh, boy. Anyway, yes, it's a serious problem at which none of the other parties want to address. Quite frankly, they have the purest approach. Everything must be, it must be completely open or bust or go away. You're not allowed to have your hardware certification number, right? It's like,
okay.
No, okay. You don't have to agree, but either,
I'm not saying that your thing doesn't solve a problem. I'm not saying that, there's a need for all this stuff. It's just like, literally, this doesn't, I don't know.
Impact
like,
you,
just,
so you don't care.
This is not a hill I'm willing to die on. I guess that's what it really comes down to. And like you're saying, though, some people are, right? And some people are like, this fits this criteria and this does not. And the one that does not allow it in our club. And you should not do this and this and this and this. And we're willing to take legal action. And at the end of the day, that's what really matters, right? Is like people are or are not willing to take legal action to do all this other stuff. And it's like, all right, that's when I usually throw my hands up and I'm like, this is not for me. So I love open source hardware. I love people that do it. I think it's an interesting concept because it does add on to stuff. One like more practical high level view I've taken on open source hardware in general is that it's not the most interesting hardware that's usually being open source. There is a lot of interesting open source hardware, but like the most interesting stuff is just not going to be open sourced. And so like, I like it when it's out there if you looked at like a heat map of like open source hardware and like what's in open source hardware, I would estimate a guess, and I could be very wrong at this, that the heat map would be very strong around the Atmega 328. And like that alone is like, all right, well, cool. Like that's great. It's out there. But like, that's less interesting to me. And so, again, I'm glad it's out there. I think that's good for learning. I love that there's open information. I love looking at the schematics. But a lot of the schematics I've looked at have had a lot of Atmega 328s. And that's less interesting to me these days. So that's all I'm saying.
Right.
As a result, I am not willing to die on that hill because, 328s.
It's not a hill anyone need die on. It's just a hill that needs to be there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hill that a lot of people want to stand on.
Sure, that's true.
Not fight, and why fight? It's like, well, there's a lot of people who want to do open source hardware the purest way, and there's others that want to have more practical oriented open, they want to share some stuff, but they don't want to share all, and there's some very good reasons for that, right? Yep. So, and there's no need for the two camps to even fight at all.
Okay.
So, it's not a hill that you have to die on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chips that I'm not seeing on many open source hardware designs, but are interesting because they're not on any open source hardware designs mostly yet because this chip just came out, is the ESP32S2. Have you seen this thing?
No. It's.
How was that for a segue? Was that okay?
Right. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's yet another thing. What's so special about it?
The interesting thing is that it was a downgrade of sorts. I talked to Jeroen about this. Sprite TM. He is one of the firmware, software, hardware guys there. He's the wizard there. One of the wizards there at Espressive. And basically, they looked at the market. They looked at the part they had out there. It was the ESP32 is a dual core power hungry beast with a ULP, the ultra low power processor on it. So basically, it's just a beast. It sucks down power, but it can do a lot of interesting things. This one is not dual core, so that's kind of interesting. So that's how it's kind of a downgrade, in my opinion, because now you're not running on a second core. You're basically sharing time on the core that's running the Wi-Fi stack.
Mm-hmm.
It also has two low-power processors in it now. One of them is a RISC-V. That's also interesting to me. What else do I remember from this Andreas Spies video that we'll be linking in here? That's the other one. It has a USB hub, not hub, USB, help me out here, Dave. What's it called when a USB, when you can just hook a USB with two lines host? Into a chip? Thinking out loud here. It is USB host, but it's not a USB host. It's a USB device, but it is the physical stuff you need for USB. Right. Basically, just like on other parts where you can just hook up D+D- right into the chip.
Sure.
It has that now.
Well, whereas okay.
ESP32 didn't have that. And so you needed you needed another chip on there. So basically now,
I got it. Okay.
Now you can just drop this chip with a USB connector and be ready to go.
It's got a USB hardware core in it.
Yes. And so, all those things are interesting, still low power, low cost rather. I haven't used it yet, but I think it's an interesting, I think the most interesting thing about it to me is the fact that it went from two cores to one.
Okay.
And, of sorts, right? Of the actual accessible normal cores that you're going to use.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. It's new chips.
Cool.
New chips out there. Yeah. Speaking of chips, former guest of the show, Sam Zaloof, showed off how he does photolithography at home using his projector and does photolithography using that. That is also very worth using. So we were talking about resources for building stuff at home. You're looking at the Google PDK and you're like, oh, that's too easy if they just give me the answers. Right. So now I should really build my own chips. You could follow Sam's steps and you could do that at home now too. So that's another one.
Very cool. I think he's pretty much got that market to himself.
There's
not too many people willing to set up a chip fab in their home.
Even Jerry Ellsworth has moved on to greener pastures there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sam posted a thing on Twitter the other day where he was actually playing a guitar pedal that he put together himself. That was very fun.
Yeah.
That was very fun.
Is he the only one in the world, really, the only amateur chip maker in the world?
There's others. But they're probably not making YouTube videos about it.
No, probably not making. Yeah, they're not hope.
I bet there's a lot more after him. That's kind of interesting. Sam, if you're listening, keep going.
The problem with it is that it's just such a high entry burden. It's massive. You've got to have. Most people don't even have the space, let alone the ability. Like he's in the US, right? He can get a lot of this gear, right? Me in Australia, good luck, right? Even if I wanted to, even if I had the I could not get the gear to do it. It'd be so prohibitive. I'd have to import it all from the US.
You should do that. Come on, man. What are you even doing here? What are you even doing here? Get on it, Dave.
Anyway, that stuff's much more readily available in the, there's all sorts of chip fabs closing down and you can get, old chip fabs and things like that. And you're just at the auction sites, you just get all this gear and,
I was watching... Yep. It was a very promo-y video. I think it was Kemet. We talk about trade on here, and the trade situation has not been getting better. There's a Steve Blank episode or post about the chip wars of 21st century. He's a technologist, writer, guy. He writes about startups a lot, but he's writing about this stuff.
Right.
But anyways, I was thinking about so right now, if you wanted to build a capacitor factory in the US, what would that take? And then I saw a Kemet.
Right.
There's how they're made. It was a promo video or something like that.
Oh, excellent. Got to see it. Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God. No, I will not be starting a capacitor factory. They do 100% test. Holy shit. Can you imagine 100% test on 0105 capacitors and stuff like that?
You have to, because the tolerances ridiculously small that the production variation, fart halfway across the factory, it's going to change the process. And then you can get a huge number of foes if you're not, of course, you're going to keep on top of that. Yeah.
And then, schlubs like us were oh my God, this... they said it was 7% accurate, but we saw it was 7.5.
Oh boy. Yeah. I mean, caps have 5-10% tolerance for a reason.
Right. Yeah, I mean, with resistors, you're just chopping some off, right? It's just like, okay, you get material, you know, what the material is. You mix it up, chop it off, and, you know, put it in there.
Multi-layer ceramic capacitors.
I don't think I could start a resistor factory. Where the hell do you even start? You know, like, you think about, like, all this conversation about, like, okay, so there are some very, very big trade issues, and I think they're going to get worse, and, yeah, we could talk about that all day long. But let's just say, yes, they are going to get worse. Yes, we, you know, different countries need to have their own resources to do this thing. Where the hell do you start? I could maybe come up with an idea of, like, at least with a semiconductor factory, you're like, ah, yeah, I guess, you know, you go buy old stuff, you start from there, right? And it's like, you could basically go to a, you know, a Tel or who are the other chip machine maker folks? I don't know. I remember Tokyo Electron. I don't remember. I used to work in this industry, Dave.
Yeah, I know.
You could go and get a catalog from one of those Applied Materials. God damn it. Got it. Applied Materials or Tel or whoever. And you could just go buy a bunch of machines. Where do you even start with resistors? You know, it's just like, is there like a resistor, like a raw resistor factory? You know, it's just like a catalog like,
yeah, yeah.
I need a truck full of resistive material, please. You know, you don't even know.
We have no idea. We take these things for granted
every single day. I have no idea how this stuff works, Dave.
Yeah,
500 episodes in, this is what I've learned. I have no idea how anything works.
You know, I have no idea how a resistor works.
I mean, I know that, like, there's a formula,
right? It's called Ohm's law, and it's,
yeah, I guess the first step would be like, hire material scientists. That's probably the best first step. Be like, you guys know what you're doing, right? Like physics and how electrons move. And my goodness, we are dumb.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that I love about electronics, though, there is so much shit to learn. I got some new boards, and I got some filters. I got some RF filters in. I got an RF amplifier, and it's under, like, so I got an RF amplifier. It goes 10 megahertz to 8 gigahertz, right? And it does like 20 dB gain. Maybe, no, 10 dB gain. And okay, cool. I bought it on Tindy. Works great. Looks awesome. It's under a little metal shield, right? And I'm like thinking about it. I'm like, what the hell is under that shield? I have no idea. How would you amplify that? Is it an op amp? I don't know. I'm going to have to rip this goddamn, I'm going to break this thing now, because I'm going to have to go rip the shield off, you know, because I'm going to have to look at this. I don't know. I don't know how to amplify this many, like, that wide of frequencies. And even if I did,
I'll tell you exactly what's in it. If you open it up, there is
going to be a single transistor, right?
No, it'll be most likely a circular plastic package with four pins on it. There'll be power, ground, there'll be input and output pin, and they usually sit flat on the board. You know, you often have to do a circular cutout. I can't remember the name of the package, right?
Right.
And you feed in the power via an inductor.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah. That's typically, you know, because they're designed for masthead amplifiers and stuff like that.
Block the high frequency.
Block the high frequencies, and, you know, passes the DC, but doesn't let the RF through. And Bob's your uncle. That's it.
I just feel like when this kind of stuff happens, 20 dB gain
chip in there.
After this, you know, like, talking about the chip, whatever the hell's in there, and then, like, you know, all of this stuff, like having Ming on the show last week too, like, so much in electronics and technology too. I'm just like, man, we're like in a cargo cult, you know, like, we pay someone money. These little bits of sand show up at our doorstep in little packets, right? We get upset about how our pick and our magic robot doesn't work. Right. There's a video about what's his name.
Oh, the charm white. Yes.
There's a shit robot. Maker. It's a bad robot. It? Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a cargo. We live in a cargo cult. That's what it is, Dave.
Right.
But it is a wonderful cargo cult. And I really enjoy it a lot of times. Sometimes I hate it.
And given that this is the 500th episode, I have to bring it up. Because back right at the start, you said, oh, yeah, oh, we'll man. Be making these oh, chips man. With our own chip printer. You knew I was going to bring it up.
I knew you did. You know, I knew you were going to bring it up? Because you said, sometimes people make predictions, and it's the best if you forget them. It's the best if they forget them.
I'm not going to forget that, dude.
I was thinking in my head, you know who doesn't forget a prediction that I made? It's David L. Jones. That is that is the man.
I've got a memory like an elephant. Yep.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Dave. Okay, so 10 years later, we're here. I don't remember what the bet was, but double or nothing.
You said 10 years. You said there would be a chip printer in 10 years. I said you won't even get it in 20. That's BS. And I still stand behind that. You still won't have one in 20 years' time. I'll make the call again. You will not have a desktop chip printer.
Double or nothing. Here's the thing. Ming was on the show last week, and I'd say that counts.
What?
So basically, it's putting silicon onto other silicon, and then you can do it via an interface. So it's basically like you're printing a new chip by... I'm just talking on my ass. I don't know. So basically, last week... I'm sure you haven't listened to the show yet. Last week, Ming...
No, I haven't.
Zhang was on the show, and he was talking about Z-Glue, and basically, it's basically doing chiplets, and then they go on a substrate, and then basically, you design the substrate, and then they have a tool that lets you make a package out of that. That is interesting, and that's... I'm just going to say that's what I had in mind.
It's interesting, but yeah. The elephant in the room is DigiKey and Mouser, who have... a couple of hundred thousand off-the-shelf chips, fully qualified in multiple packages that cost cents each. And you think that somebody's going to come up with a chip? It's ridiculous. It's the dumbest idea in history. It's not going to happen.
That is not the dumbest idea in history, and you know
You've
it.
You've worked in the chip. It is. Dave, well, no, it's not a dumb idea. It's great. It's not practical.
You watch the dumbest idea in history every Saturday whenever you watch these Amazon Prime movies. So let's just get that straight. It is not the dumbest idea in history.
It's the most impractical idea in industry. In history. It's not going to work.
I would say...
You know. You've worked in the... You know what goes into making a qualified chip.
It is increasingly unlikely that we will get it on our desktop. However, think of the other things we've talked about in this episode. Open source PDK, so people have access to chips factories.
Yeah.
So,
fine.
You know,
yeah, of course.
There's more of that.
Yeah. Okay.
Dave, I'm grasping at straws here. Give me a little... 500 friggin' episodes later, give me a little wiggle room here.
No, none. You've already said it to yourself. It's asymptote. The odds of a chip printer are asymptoting towards zero. And it was already there 10 years ago. You just wanted to hold out. So I'm going to rub it in. I'm going to continue to rub it in. I'm not going to give you an inch. Okay. No.
All right. That's fine. But you know what? Here's the thing. If we hit a 30-year mark by then, who knows? Who knows, Dave?
No. Still cool.
Here's the other thing. Okay. So let's talk about a little sci-fi stuff. People are like, click, end of episode. Some practical realities, right? So like, we're hopefully moving towards being a, you know, multiplanetary species, you know,
not gonna
Mr.
happen
crazy either. Crazy man Elon Musk is, you know, being crazy, very increasingly crazy. But I think it is likely that, you know, we're going to go back to the moon at some point, Mars, and whatever. Okay,
of
so
course.
Now maybe people are hanging out around Mars. Let's say 100 years from now, they're hanging out around Mars. They're maybe not living on Mars. But like, do you have to ship chips there? Like,
Yes, that's the whole point. You got to ship everything there. This is why a Mars colony is not going to work. I've done a video on this. It is because people don't realize that just the basic stuff.
Sci-fi books really gloss over that. Like, so I love the book Seven Eves. I've talked about it many times. They actually, so Stevenson does talk about it.
I've been meaning to read that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've been talking about that for about 5 out of 10 years here.
Yeah.
But he does talk about it. He talks about the main character. She basically has like a store of chips, and she like stores them inside like a metal asteroid that they're hanging out on, that she has like a little compartment in there to like radiation shielding. That part is fantastic, but then like then somehow a, you know, culture springs up later, and it's like, okay, all right, well, you know, okay.
Well, the whole chip printer thing, I used to love this series. I can't remember what it was called, but it was where they went back into the time and there were dinosaurs. Like, and they went, like, and they set up a colony back in...
Land of the Lost?
It's like...
You want to watch some bad movies /TV, Land of the Lost is it.
Right. They had a chip printer. They famously had a chip printer because they took a, you know, because they have to repair stuff back in there. So they could, they had this chip printer that they could chip print replacement chips to keep all this stuff going. And people don't realize a Mars colony, it requires, people don't appreciate the massive not only the manufacturing infrastructure, but the logistics infrastructure and everything else that goes into just making the bare necessities to keep you alive, let alone all your fancy stuff like your bloody iPhones, right? People don't realize you can't replicate that on Mars. Everything still will still have to come from Earth. You can't do it. You can't get a self-sustaining colony on Mars. It's not possible. They'll just die out without replacements from Earth. Simple as that. And it's going, that's going to be the same. That's going to be like that for hundreds of years. Yeah. Hundreds. And like, you know, you have to so massively terraform it that then you can produce all the same, even the basic necessities here. People take like their clothes for granted. You know, how much effort goes into producing clothes? You know how much infrastructure that goes energy, into producing just the basic stuff, right? Unless you want to walk around, you know, naked and with just your farming and just eating your Mars. No, roam around naked eating your you know, growing your beans you've grown in your greenhouse or whatever, and that's it. That's your entire life.
Your crap potatoes.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. I mean, it's just ludicrous. People aren't practical enough. They don't think about the practicalities of it.
Well, Dave, we have to drive towards that. I think there's some.
Of course, we have to drive towards it. I'm not saying don't. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm not saying we'll probably be on Mars in the next 20 years. I'm not saying we won't. We definitely will. But you know, I mean,
you're just saying they're gonna pack a lunch. You're saying they're gonna pack a picnic.
Yep. It's no, they cannot survive without replenishments from here. It's just not gonna happen. So unfortunately, I would love. Like I'm huge. Like you won't get a bigger space buff than me, right? Who wants to, you know, I want to believe in the Mars colony. A moon colony will happen before a Mars colony happens because it's so close. We can just get, you know, send freight up there in a couple of days, right? It's easy.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm. Yep.
Well,
calm down now.
That was a bit of a downer.
What?
It's a bit of a downer, Dave.
I'm sorry. I'm a practical engineer. I like sue me. This is an engineering podcast. It's like practicalities matter, you know? Like, this isn't fantasy podcast.
Yes. I know. Hey, look, I will start a fantasy podcast in a second. I will talk about sci-fi all day long.
Listen to it. Yeah, go for it.
The Bobaverse. Read the Bobaverse. I love it. The Bobaverse.
What's the Bobaverse?
I've talked about the Bobaverse on here before. It's a 3-book series. It's about a guy dies in like the first chapter, and then but his brain becomes
thanks for the spoiler.
An AI in the future, basically. And then he kind of goes to like, so basically because he's an AI, or he's like a, you know, his brain is like captured in a computer. He can replicate himself. And then he goes and takes over the stars. It's awesome. It's a great book.
Right.
It's a great 3 books. I love it. Go read it. Listen to it. It's actually even better as an audiobook.
Okay.
Great book. Great set of books.
I can't read at the moment. My Kindle's dead.
Well, yeah, you should listen to them, Dave. Listen to books.
Oh, okay.
Just, especially people listen to this thing. If you like podcasts, you're going to love audiobooks.
Yep. Agreed. Yeah, I do enjoy audiobooks. I prefer it when it's spoken by the author, though.
Yeah, sometimes, not always.
Yeah, not always. Some authors suck, you know.
Yeah, I think like nonfiction for sure. But like fiction, no, I want like a voice actor.
All right.
I talked about on here, I think it was with a guest, or maybe it was when just a guest co-host or something. But the idea of like having podcasts where like you read technical papers, like having like audio-based like technical resources.
Reading technical.
Like not like, oh, not like, not like abstract, you know, see figure 1.4.8, but like actual, like, you know, technical, I don't know. It was like based off the idea of like Autumn, which is I don't think I heard back from anyone about it. I like mentioned it on here. No one said anything they're interested about it. So I kind of dropped it, but I still like that idea of like listening to technical content and like being able to like capture, you know, somewhat complex. It's really going to be pointers towards complex content because I don't think that it's possible to really dig in deep. You know, like I said,
no, but you need like a summary. You need like a, like if you reckon there's a niche out there for a podcast of like a summary of, well, I kind of watch a guy on YouTube and Anton Petrov, What the Math. Anyways, channel's called Anton Petrov. And he basically does that. Like every day he releases like a space science related video where he just talks about like a latest, you know, research paper that's been released. But he animates
What if you fell
like,
into Saturn? That's cool.
Yeah. Like, you know, there's like, but they're all based. Every episode's like usually based on like recent research and he links to the publication. So if you want to go read the publication, you can, you know, if you want to go read the paper. You can, but he just gives you like a overall summary and tries to simulate how, you know, this new neutron star, you know,
that's cool,
spins and all sorts of stuff. Yeah, I'm totally addicted to that.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so like that kind of thing, like basically like reading abstracts and but also contextualizing, right? So like
Yes, you've got to make it exciting.
This is interesting because it's you know, a wide range of topics.
Hard to do it as a podcast. It's more easier to do it with visual. stuff.
Especially when we don't read the articles beforehand. Don't forget about that, Dave.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, no, there's I agree. There could be a niche out there for people reading papers and the latest papers and, and pulling out the interesting stuff. But you've got to make it exciting, so that's the trick. That's the ticket, it's laddie. Anecdotes. Make it exciting.
Anecdotes, Dave.
Anecdotes.
That's what people like. What people like.
That's what the young folks like these days.
Are there any other anecdotes we should be talking about here on the, or I guess links? We have like 4 weeks worth of links. So...
Yeah, we did because we were, I don't know, just didn't do a show for 4 weeks or something. Don't know why.
Here's some like, so basically I've been dumping links in here as I find them. So like a lot of them are RF based right now, but there's an RF PCB simulation cookbook from TI. I'll link that. That's pretty cool. And you know, some of these are like, I go and look at them to dig in later.
Yep.
KiCad has some new RF tools because they're not great with RF yet, but those are interesting. What else? There was the Navy Electricity and Electronics Trading Series.
They've got they've released all the training material or whatever.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yep.
And then there was one other one. Oh, it was from Contiki, IoT in 5 days. I thought this was interesting. So it's like an ebook almost. And basically Contiki is like one of the,
it's a tour group as far as I know.
Yeah, right. They also do that. Yeah. Right. I mean, that's also the same name. I'm not sure what Contiki stands for, but this is basically like, so like they go through sensors and like what is, so Contiki is an OS and then basically it's, they talk about sensors and how to set up wireless and all the different things, but it's like kind of just a good overall look at like building a small wireless system with sensors, including up through like using Contiki to talk over IPv6 and things like that. So like,
right.
That's a very tall stack, I think, you know, to go from low level hardware all the way up to sending packets. But I think that actually resonates a lot with,
that document's very comprehensive.
Yeah.
Looks very, wow. Yeah. Someone's put a lot of work into that. Multiple people have put,
Someone, people in Italy, it's a school, I think. So
there are Italian names. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And .it is the domain. So that,
anyway,
that helps. But
it's
from 2015, so keep that in mind. Right. You know that it's an old thing, but you know it checks out. So that's. Oh, and then here's one other one. I guess it's a video. I mean, I'm always linking to Alan Wolke's stuff. Alan's been on the show before. I've talked to him about coming back on. He said he's very busy right now. So, but you know his stuff is amazing.
I know you're fanboying over his V&A stuff.
I mean, it's great. It's great. Like, I wish it was there. I wish it was there before I bought mine. You know what I mean?
Right,
like, that's what
right.
I've learned this stuff through like talking to Jeff Kaiser a lot, and you know, just struggling. Mm. Someone asked me today, like, how have I learned RF? And I was like, oh, well, usually I buy something and then I struggle to use it, and then I call a friend, and then I ask on Twitter. And then I go back and like, you know, like just the usual way of learning things.
Right.
I guess. Yeah.
And there's an interactive guide to Maxwell's equations for all you Maxwell fanboys. If you just can't get enough of those weird symbols, you know.
Curl. Give me the curl, man. Got to do my curls. Hit the Maxwell gym.
Yeah. It's like, there's fun bedtime reading right there, Maxwell.
Yeah, because you will be out.
Yeah. There's some people who just love that stuff. You know, I was never into, you know, that just wasn't a thing for me.
Okay. One last thing about books. I'm reading a book right now called Ultra Learning, and he talks about transference. And this is like an argument against like traditional education. It's the transference has been like disproven actually in different studies.
What transference are we talking about?
So like transference would be, okay, so you go and sit in a class.
Of the information into your brain, processed into your brain.
No, that is a type of transference, but no, this is actually like the assumption that learning the theory and then being able to then take okay, let's talk about Ohm's law, right? Yeah. You go and sit in a classroom and you do all the math and you learn Ohm's law, and the transference is the assumption that you will then go and be able to use that in the lab and basically apply this abstract concept to a very physical, hard, real world thing. And that has been disproven many things. And I'm of course going to talk about books that resonate with me. This book is just like, it's got my, you know, contextual, you know, alarm bells ringing.
Of course.
So like, take that with a grain of salt, but it's an interesting book. And the thing I like most about it is it's very practical. It gives you like different things you can do. Like it talks about creating drills for yourself, like you might with a sport or music or something like that.
Right, okay.
And things that like, you know, with like electronics, what do drills look like for electronics? It's like, oh, okay. And so I've just been kind of thinking through that, and it might become part of contextual electronics at some point, but it's a very interesting concept that I don't see talked about too much, other than like make more circuit boards or do more electronics is like more drills, but that's not very specified. So I think that's a good topic for a future show of like, what do drills and electronics look like? And I'd love to hear from people if they have thoughts.
Well, you dribble the electrons over here and then you dribble this way and you pass
that
right. way. And you...
That's right, right. You gotta do fancy footwork. Don't forget about that.
Interesting.
Oh, shit. One last thing. I'm sorry. I've been swearing a lot this episode. There is a giveaway. We have a giveaway. So this is actually... this is an interesting, I should have put this on the list, but it is called the Quick Feather. And this is a new type of, I'll have to send you the link real quick.
I've got it.
You do. Okay, great. So it's a new type of chip that's got, the chip doesn't seem like it's, the company doesn't seem like it's going to stick around that long. And I hesitate to say that just because like Quick Logic, it just sounds like, I'm sure it just seems like they're not going to be around long. Just given that name, for some reason, it just strikes me as like a, yeah, I mean, like it's a, you know, I'm sure they've been around. I'm sure they're fine, Chris. Right? I know. I sound like a mean person, but basically, it's a dev board for this chip, and it's got an integrate. So it's basically a Cortex M4 with an FPGA built into it, right? And so basically, it's like flexible fabric, and the whole idea is it's like a chip that's meant to. Basically, meant to like process.
Oh, so the Quick Logic. It's the Quick Logic EOS S3 chip.
That's right. Yes.
So it's a system on chip. Okay. So they've done their own. Right. Okay.
Exactly. And so like it's like specified to be like for like machine learning type of thing. So if you had like a microphone, it has like a microphone input for it. Right. And then that goes into a bit of, I think, hard logic that then you can then connect to with the FPGA fabric. And basically, so it's like a design that this company had made that basically is they bought the ARM core, they put some flexible logic around it, and they built these custom blocks that do a bunch of different things. It's meant to be like it handles different functions for, you know, IoT type devices and stuff like that. And edge AI and ML, blah, 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 blah.
And we're giving one away, are we?
We're giving one away.
How do we do that?
I'm going to come up with a questionnaire. And if you fill it out, one person will be sent one of these things. So it'll probably be about learning or something like that. We've done that in the past, but I did say I give one away, and we can ship anywhere in the world. So that's not a problem. And it looks like a cool board. That's also like I'm interacting with the Crowd Supply folks. So
the Crowd Supply. Yes. It's on Crowd Supply. Yep. It got funded. Yep.
Yes. Yep. I think it was a $1, cool. $1.
Your goal.
$1 goal.
Goal.
So, okay.
Smash that goal.
we knew it was going to, 23,000, 23,000% funded or whatever it is.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Cool. Oh,
that's it.
That's it. Well, that's it for the show.
Half a order of magnitude over.
Yep. Yeah. Half an order. Yep. Near enough.
Would an order of magnitude be like if you're going from 10 to 1,000 though?
Well, so wouldn't it be two like, orders of magnitude.
That's two orders of magnitude.
And an order of magnitude more than 10 times is 100. And then two orders of magnitude is 1,000.
Right. Two so orders like, of but like 500 wouldn't really be half an order of magnitude, would it? I mean, it's like.
Oh, well, it depends what your baseline is, right?
Right. Yeah.
If your baseline's 1,000.
This is just me getting back at you for the.
I get you. Yeah.
Be like 450 would have been like half. Yeah. Anyways.
But once again, it's we're going to the order. You know, going to half an order. It's near enough.
I think we could just say 500 is pretty cool. So, congrats, Dave. We did it. We got to five. Let's say 512 though. Let's get.
Yeah.
To
yes. Woo! Yeah. Party poppers. The excitement is palpable. It is. That's it. Yep. Show over. Catch you next time.
Yep. See ya.